Well, hello there. Who are you?
This is the Zodiac speaking.
Killing must feel good to God, too. He does it all the time. And are we not created in his image?
We all go a little mad sometimes.
After all, murder is, or should be, an art.
I could kill you now pretty easily. Do some interesting things before anyone showed up.
What are these films you can't wait to look at?
Billy Idol fans, I'm very sorry. This episode is not an hour talking about the 1983 banger. Welcome to the Final Girls podcast and the fifth episode in our series dedicated to on-screen serial killers of horror film history. I'm Anna Bogutska, your podcast host and problematic men in wet white shirt competition judge. This episode covers two films that exist in a loose category that I've described as, huh? Was there even a serial killer in this? In Georges Franju's 1960 classic, Eyes Without a Face, a grief-stricken surgeon kills young women to procure a new face for his disfigured daughter because she better not live and she's not pretty. And in William Wyler's Cannes-winning The Collector from 1963, Terence Stamp plays a young man who kidnaps and keeps a young woman in his basement because he loves her a whole bunch. These films are portraits of serial killers who think they aren't serial killers at all. And I'm joined by editor and video essayist Maha Albadrawi to discuss the why and the how of both these films. If either Eyes Without a Face or The Collector are new to you, I encourage you to discover them both. The Collector in particular is a thoroughly messed up masterpiece. You can see all of the other films that I'm going to be discussing during this series over on our Letterboxd page, which I'll link in the show notes. And if you enjoy this episode, can you give a girl a little Apple Podcast review? Really helps listeners discover the show and new problematic horror crushes. If you're thirsting for more content, I'm also publishing reviews of new films over on the Final Girls Patreon page. And with all of that said, please enjoy our take on Eyes Without a Face and The Collector. Maha, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about some very problematic serial killers.
I am so excited to talk about this with you, Anna. Thank you so much for having me.
So I've been asking this of everyone who's coming on to the show for this series. Did you have your own serial killer phase?
I did, and I have no idea where it came from. I just know that sometime in my late teens, I started watching a lot of crime and investigation channel, and I don't know why. No idea why. It kept me up at night. You know, it made me...
scared you?
Yes, it did, because they were all documentaries. They were all the things about, like, BTK killer and just these... I don't even remember a lot of them. I just inhaled them for some reason. And I remember when I met my husband, well, then boyfriend, now husband, and, you know, he'd just sort of, like, catch me watching them at night. He'd be like, why are you doing this? It gives you nightmares. And I'm like, I don't know, but I do.
So what do you think of them when you think of serial killers in the movies?
I think, do you mean like compare the real ones with the fake ones?
However you choose to interpret that question.
I think that they make really interesting characters because they sort of operate outside of normal human bounds, normal human, you know, social rules in movies, sorry, in film, in fiction. I kind of feel like in films, they're often, I mean, a lot of serial killers, even in real life, they're men. They're usually like men. There's some sort of like social isolation that happens with them. There's usually like a tragic childhood backstory. And I think in films, they are, maybe this is a problem, but like they kind of deified a little bit. They sort of, they're fascinating characters. Whereas in the documentaries, like the Crime and Investigation Channel documentaries that I used to watch, they're always like, this guy was scum, you know, this guy was scum. And, you know, they talk, there was a lot of focus on the victims and the victims' families. And it was a different angle to what I see in films.
And the crimes themselves. I feel like true crime documentaries tend to focus a lot on the actual grisly details.
The impact, yeah.
Yeah. Whether it's kind of the fictional serial killers are much more interested in the psychology and the character study of these type of usually men, but not always.
Yes, and I sometimes feel like that has a really strange side effect. And, you know, it's something that we saw with, like, the Dahmer series, which I didn't watch, but I saw what happened online with people kind of going like, oh, I find him attractive, which is something that I have felt that, like, when I watched The Fall with Jamie Dornan, again,
yeah.
I found him very attractive. And his victims looked a little bit like me at the time. Like, they were, like, curvy brunettes with brown hair, like, long brown hair. And, yeah, that was weird. That was a weird thing to think. But I didn't say it out loud, like other people seem to say out loud on the internet. I'm like, well, here I go saying it on the internet, though. Interesting.
The two films that we're discussing in this episode are kind of maybe a bit of a cheat for this series. Do you think of Eyes Without a Face and The Collector as serial killer movies?
I actually did wonder, because I watched The Collector first, and I had wondered whether I would maybe was watching the wrong film, because it's, as we'll get into it, it's not a film about a serial killer until the very, very, very end, the last shots. Then I thought, oh, okay, I can see how this fits in. And then with Eyes Without a Face, he's sort of an accidental serial killer.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's why I wanted to include them, because like you said, I find that this type of horror movie, that kind of very focused on the killer and the psychology of the killer, are so much character studies, that these two films are very much about the guys who perpetrate the crimes and like their motivations, which they find completely justified and even loving. So it's like a different side to the same serial killer coin, because we could absolutely see them going on with their shenanigans after the film is over. Well, not in the case of Eyes Without a Face, but we'll get to that.
Yeah, I think serial killer has sort of turned into like a brand with recognizable traits, but it's at its function. I think these two, the men at the centers of both of these films are by definition serial killers. Whether they intended to be or not, doesn't matter. They did. They are serial perpetrators.
So let's start with Eyes Without a Face from 1960. When did you first see this film, or when did you first hear about this film?
I feel like I've been aware of this film for a long time, because I've seen that image of the expressionless mask. But I actually watched it for the first time for this podcast. And I'm glad I did, because I've always wanted to watch it. But I have also been aware of the Billy Idol song.
Hell yeah. That's the number one Google result when you Google Eyes Without a Face. It's not the 1960 George Franju movie. It's a fucking Billy Idol song, which is a banger.
It is. It's a soft rock banger. And, you know, I'm familiar with that song. And I'm, yeah, and this film has just sort of, it's just been one of those classic films that I've been wanting to watch for all my life. I am sure it's on the 100 Greatest Films Sight and Sound poll, probably. And I'm really glad I watched it, because it's very interesting.
It's one of those things that I remember discovering this film, I think like a lot of films, when I was living in Paris. So I was like very much surrounded by the history of French cinema. And French cinema is not something that you ordinarily associate with horror films. And way before New French Extremity, which is kind of what we think about now, there just wasn't that many. They weren't popular. They weren't considered respectable enough. But there's these outliers, and there's all the French fantastique kind of subgenre, which is not strictly horror, but it's horror adjacent. And then there's Eyes Without a Face, which is so melancholy and also dark and kind of fantastical and a little bit sci-fi, but also has quite distinct elements of gore to it. So tell me, like, what was your impression going into for the first time?
I thought it would be more of a horror, like more of a visual horror than it actually was. I think it's more of like a study in obsession and anguish than it is in a horror. There's no jump scare. Well, there's a couple of jump scares, but there's no build up and release. It's more of like a slow strangle of a film. And it's quite poetic and really, you know, really sad as well, because there's definitely an element of tragedy with the Christiane character. And also all of the women that, you know, that we come across in the film. That I think it's interesting that they had to cut down on the gore to please the censors, because they had to deal with like different kinds of censorships from French censors, German censors, and I think US censors. So all those different angles, they had to cut down on the gore in the making of the film. But what that does to me is that actually it makes the gory bits even more visceral. Like that's the goriest bits are, I couldn't believe how like how gross they were, how much I could feel them happening. Should we talk about those gory bits?
Listen, you brought it up. Let's go into the face transplanting.
Oh, that face transplant scene. So simple. Just one locked off shot of... I mean, you see it happening. You see it start to happen. He's drawing the line around the face, which we know when he's the doctor is about to graft one face to another. And you think, okay, he's going to cut away. They're going to cut away. They're going to cut. And then they don't cut away. And then you suddenly realize he's going to do the whole thing right in front of you in this one static locked off shot. And it's so unflinching.
And it's right bang in the middle of the film. And he lifts the skin off of this poor young woman's face like it's a goddamn paper face mask.
Yeah.
And for anyone who's not seen The Eyes Without a Face before, I mean, you should, but also before we go into the second kind of element of gore in it, tell me about this main character, you know, the killer in question, or the reluctant serial killer in question, Dr. Genesier. How would you describe his methods and his obsession?
I think as an archetype, he's a mad scientist type, and he's someone who's driven by grief. He's, before the film starts, he's lost his wife, and his daughter has been disfigured in a car accident, which I think he was responsible for. Is that correct?
I think that's the implication, yeah.
Yeah. So he's definitely in a bad way. He's grieving, he's feeling guilty, and he's a serial killer. Like we said before, he's an accidental serial killer. I don't think that he's a serial killer who derives pleasure from suffering. He doesn't seem to enjoy suffering. And there's one particular scene where he helps a boy with his sight. So you could tell he's got some sort of moral compass. It's his own moral code that he follows. And I think the thing that makes him scary is that he lacks empathy. He doesn't lack empathy for everything and everyone, but he's able to compartmentalize his his morals enough in a way that allows him to take life from other people, from other families, and it was his own sort of justification.
I think he's a doctor. He's a plastic surgeon. He has a certain surgical coldness to him. And I think that's the thing that makes him so interesting and chilling. Because as much as we're told that he's grieving, the way that that grief metastasizes is into him trying to fix the thing that is unfixable. you know, he cannot bring his wife back, but he can give his daughter her face back, even though it's not her face. But because his daughter, he obviously places more importance on the life of his daughter, he does not care how many other young women he has to kill, because they're only prime material for his surgery. I don't think he even sees them as human. I don't think he sees them as like having a life. It's more, it's so kind of clinical, you know, when he's like, does this face, does this skin fit? I think he sees every one of his victims through the lens of his daughter, through Christiane.
Yeah. Yeah, he sees them as body parts, like yes. as parts for, you know, for his project. Do you think that he looks at his daughter that way? Because he's placing so much importance on her beauty rather than her well-being.
Well, there's something, when I was watching it again, I mean, there's something really haunting about the imagery of it, about this, the image of Christiane, which has become so kind of famous and kind of often referenced, of this, you know, blank white face and just the eyes that are alive and everything else is sort of unmoving.
Yeah.
But there's nothing there. And it is very... it is very ableist and through kind of a contemporary lens, because it's doing the thing that every single James Bond movie and many horror movies and kind of more mainstream movies do, which is like, oh, you have some sort of scar or disfigurement or disability, well, you're the villain, aren't you?
Oh, yeah.
But in this case, kind of Christiane is the one, we'll talk about her a little bit more, but I find it interesting that it's him who is placing all this pressure on her. She is kind of, you know, being very melancholy about not being able to touch her face, not being able to recognize herself in the mirror, not being able to like go outside. And he's the one who fakes her death, organizes a whole ass funeral for her, because he'd rather people think she was dead than people see her with a scarred face, without being beautiful. And I think there's kind of, I think that imposition that is purely his on her value being only in her face is the thing that kind of drives her a bit mad, especially towards the end. What do you think?
I completely agree. And I'm wondering if you felt the same way, that there is some sort of comment on patriarchy in this film and the way that the men's only... concern when it comes to the woman, their main concern is with their beauty and how they present. Like, there's a scene in the police station when there's a woman being taken in for shoplifting, and the first thing they say is, "Oh yeah, I'm talking about that. I'm having this problem with the girl with the beautiful blue eyes." It's their first and main impression of every woman in this film is based on her appearance, her beauty. And it's so stifling, because it's what drives these men to push these women into really dangerous situations.
Well, I don't think it's just the men in this film. I think kind of beauty and horror are deeply intertwined. And there's a new book coming out by Alexandra West, which I've had the pleasure of reading an early copy of, that kind of deals with precisely that intersection, which I found so interesting. And there's something in what you're saying about kind of how, I don't think it's just the men telling the women that they have to be beautiful. I think it's a deeply internalized thing, because beauty and pretty privilege, or whatever you want to call it, or the hotness tax, I love all those variations, is of huge importance in the world.
Yeah.
Beautiful people navigate the world more easily.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I was saying about Christiane, it is going to be much more difficult for her to be in the world with her post-accident face than it is for her to be, to walk around with a face that no longer exists for her, you know, the way that she looked before. And yeah. It's interesting that, I mean, obviously we see the actress after a what the transplant that seems to work and then doesn't work.
Yeah.
But the idea here being that it's not actually her face, that it's another girl's face transplanted onto her, which I find to be such a scary thought of having someone else's face on your own.
Yeah. And it and your body rejecting it as well.
Yeah.
That sequence was really clever. It's just a series of photos with a voiceover, but just the way that her eyes change, the expression in her eyes is so sad.
Yeah, it's very Chris Marker, that sequence, and I loved it because, again, it's sort of how can you present kind of body horror in a completely inventive way? Just a series of very clinical photographs that have a real haunting quality to them.
Yes, they do.
So, you know, how do you feel about Christiane? Do you think that she's the main victim of the film, or do you think that she's kind of participating in her father's killings in some way?
I get the impression from her performance that she's a victim, and that she, it doesn't feel like she has a choice in the participation. Like, she's definitely aware of what happens. She sees what happens. But she's quite young for her age. I think in the film they say that she's 20 years old, but she seems to be like a very young, sheltered 20-year-old. We know that she's grieving. She's grieving the loss of her mother, and she's also probably grieving she's traumatized from the accident, from the loss of her face.
Mm-hmm.
I got the feeling from her that she's conflicted, but she feels powerless. And this also kind of comes across in her costumes, her everything she wears. The actress I've got is Ida Scope.
Mm-hmm.
Ida Scope's so tiny. She's so thin. She's waif-like. And they put her in these huge enveloping robes.
Mm-hmm.
And it just feels like she is overwhelmed and she's stuck in the situation. She doesn't really seem to have any agency in it.
Mm.
So I see her as a victim of her father. I think she's a victim of how she's been raised and the control that he exerts over her.
Mm.
Yeah.
I love that because I sort of had a different experience watching it this time around, because I'm like, yeah, she is a victim of her father's imprisonment and his mad obsession with restoring her face. He's done it before. He did it for his assistant, Louise, and she has the scar on her neck that she covers up with a pearl necklace. But I find that towards the middle in particular, the way that she kind of looks forward to wearing this girl's face on hers, of restoring her beauty or even improving it. You know, this really chilling comment that Louise says where she's like, oh, you're more beautiful now than before even. I was like, oh, great. Mm. And it only took killing another woman.
Louise.
And there's a moment towards the end when, you know, there's another girl on the operating table and she sort of like comes at her with a knife. And I hadn't seen this film in a while, fully thought that she was just going to try to cut her own cut her face off herself.
Yes, yeah, I forgot about that part.
Yeah. And then she stabs Louise in the most hilariously French way, where she approaches her so very slowly. And Louise is like, no, put it down. Put it down. Why did you do that? Why did you stab me? I love it. It's like the chicest way of getting stabbed right in the neck through the pearls.
Yes. Man, those pearls must have been fake.
I mean, obviously. But you mentioned that there's another great moment of gore in this film. What was that? What was the other one for you?
I'm thinking of when we see her face without the mask. Is that what you were thinking of?
I was thinking of the dogs.
The dogs. Wait, yeah. When they attack?
Yeah, when Dr. Genesir is killed by a pack of dogs that eat him alive.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that thing.
Oh, my God, of course. Yes, yeah, that's right at the end. Yeah. Like, I love that we both had completely different
yeah.
like versions of gore. Oh my god, yes. And he's killed by his own prisoners, which is just so beautiful. And it's just such a, such a poetic way of wrapping up this story.
Do you think it's what do you think is a better way to go? Via Christian stabbing you very elegantly on Dr. Gunnisier's operating table, or by dog?
I'm going to go with the elegant stabbing because, you know, open casket.
And, you know, you talked a little bit about Christiane's, the design of her, how she's like this waif-like, almost ghost-like figure. What do you think of the design of the mask?
I think it's so clever because, you know, there's two ways you can go about this. You can go with something completely like grotesque and surreal, or completely blank. And there's something about a completely blank face that is terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. And a lot of this depends on, it means that the physicality of the performer is really important here. So you have Christiane, who, like I said, is very frail. She's very, she's got this really long neck, and she's not physically imposing in any way, and that just makes her seem tragic and unpredictable as well. Like, you don't I don't know what's going on with this person when I look at that mask, and that is scary.
Yeah.
And then you've got that kind of mask works differently when you put it on someone, say, like Mike Myers on Halloween.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's huge, or even like Leatherface, huge, you know, and that's scary in a different way because they're physically imposing, but you don't know what they're thinking. You don't know what they're going to do. Like, you take away someone's expression and their individuality, and suddenly they just become this meat puppet.
Yeah. The inability to know or see what someone is kind of feeling or how they're reacting, kind of how their face reacts to the world or to you, is weirdly chilling.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you bring up her neck, because that was one thing as well I was focusing on watching the film this time around. I was like, God, she has like a swan-like long neck.
Yeah.
And it almost makes her more vulnerable. I don't know, maybe because the neck is such a vulnerable place in the body anyway.
They're like, exposed.
Yeah. And, you know, it's such a, it's the indelible image of eyes without a face, is this really sad, abandoned eyes, but you cannot tell if it's a real person or if it's a doll almost.
I can't tell from the hero images of this film, like the poster images, I couldn't tell before I watched it whether she was the monster or the victim.
Yeah.
So that's the effect of that mask. And I also found it really interesting that, you know, I did a little bit of research and I found out that Edith Scobe had been treated for an eating disorder when she was a teenager. And I think that that's, knowing that about her made her feel even more kind of like vulnerable. This, her, I don't know, her waif-likeness is, I think that contributes to her performance in a really interesting way. She seems vulnerable. But then, you know, at the end, she does take control of the situation. She flips.
Yeah. Kills everyone and walks away into the woods.
I know. And I'm dying to know what happens next.
And do you see the film's influence visually or otherwise in other horror movies or anyone else or anywhere else?
I do. It did make me think, it's obviously influenced by Frankenstein, but I find it interesting that in Frankenstein, Dr. Frankenstein is bringing the dead back to life, whereas here he's, you know, it's the opposite. He's unaliving some woman to help his daughter. Something about this film made me think of Poor Things as
Okay.
well. Yeah. Maybe it was the whole father figure, you know, the whole father-daughter dynamic. And also him having a male assistant who falls in love with his, or who is in love with his creation. The Mike Myers mask.
Yeah.
I think that had to be an influence.
And obviously, Pedro Almodovar's The Skin I Live In, I think is the first thing I think about, because he also uses kind of a more modernized version of this blank mask. Yeah. And it's also about a doctor who kidnaps a person and puts them and does things to them. I don't want to go into more because I'll probably cover that film at some point. Love that film. Don't want to rewatch it.
I want to watch it. I haven't watched it, but I want to. But yeah, I think I need to be ready for it. Mm-hmm. The other thing I was thinking of was Face Off, which is not as poetic, but you know, it's got John Travolta. It's got Nicolas Cage.
I think when Nicolas Cage is dressed like a priest and humping the air in an airport, I think that's poetry.
I don't disagree with you, Anna. I don't disagree. And Silence of the Lambs?
That's what I was thinking too. Hannibal Lecter's mask.
Yeah, and the guy who puts on, what's the name of the killer? Is Buffalo Bill?
Yes.
Yes, something about it, because he's obsessed with women. Mm. He's, and I know that archetype is very problematic. I get it. But this did make me think of that.
Yeah, it did make me think of Hannibal's mask for sure. So let's move on to the second film we're going to be discussing, where another guy traps a woman in a basement out of love. Tell me about your first impression of The Collector. Was this the first time you were watching it as well?
This is the first time I was watching it, mm-hmm. and I think the first time I was even aware of it, which is bonkers because as a teenager, I was obsessed with like Swinging London and, you know, like films of that era. And I don't know why I haven't heard of this one.
Honestly, that's offensive.
I know.
I think I would expect a mad letter from Mr. Terrence Stamp.
I would love to receive a letter from Mr. Terrence Stamp. Mr. Terrence Stamp, if you want to email me, if you want to have coffee, I'm here.
So tell me about your first impressions of The Collector.
I have so many impressions. first of all, there's the real estate aspect of this.
Oh my god, yes. Yes, talk to me about the house.
Terry, okay, Mr. Terrence Stamp. First thing he does is he buys a Tudor mansion in Tunbridge Wells, which is just smart. This is a smart thing to do. This is a good decision.
But also, let's point out that he wins the pools. I don't know what that means. He wins a sort of lottery. So he randomly, he's not wealthy, but randomly has a big chunk of money. And he's like, well, I'm going to invest in real estate because that's how you build wealth.
Yes. Which is, again, smart. I think you and I both had the same problem with this film, which is that, like, it's all a matter of perspective. Like, is he the villain or is he just like a smart guy making good investments and who really knows how to dress?
I mean,
we'll get into that later. Let's wait until later in this episode to cancel ourselves.
If you want to cancel yourself, be my guest.
Worth it. But so yeah, the pools. That's an interesting thing that you bring up because I also didn't know what that was, and I googled it, and it's this kind of like lottery where people bet on football results, and because you're betting on really random things, there's the chance that you could win a lot of money for very low investments. It's also something that is, I think, was back then considered a working class thing to do.
Okay. So,
and to me, that means that Terrence, who's playing Freddie,
mm-hmm.
He's a working class guy who comes into a lot of money, and I think to me this film is a lot of it is about class and
totally
social mobility, which is something that is ingrained in every bit of British culture, but in a way that makes people so uncomfortable.
Oh, 100%. And you know, neither one of us is British, so it is something that we have, just witnessed. On a personal note, kind of observed from an external perspective, having not grown up here, but having lived here for a good chunk of time now.
Yeah, definitely. It's something that it makes me understand British films, especially of that era, differently. Like, I remember watching Quadrophenia and not really getting I had this moment where I was just like, what is this kid's problem? He has a good job and he like lives in London with his family. He seems like he has a great life. And then later on, I was like, oh, he's there's some sort of class tension here. He knows he's never going to ascend because he's not from the middle class. I get it now.
Yeah, and there is, you know, to put it in context, and particularly, and we'll talk a lot more about Terrence Stamp and his performance, but this film also came out at a time where there was this generation of working class British actors who were getting starring roles and getting a lot of notoriety and a lot of success, and that was really unheard of. And, you know, these are names that are now icons of British cinema, you know, Stamp, Richard Harris, Tom Mike Courtney. Kane. Yeah, so all of these names kind of rose up during this era in the 60s and were very much emblematic of youth culture, to put a nice bow on it. So what do you make broadly of Terrence Stamp's performance as Freddy?
I thought it was really good. I thought it was really interesting. Terrence Stamp is, you know, he's from the East End. He himself is he's a Cockney. And I think he, in this performance, is doing a really good job of playing someone who is working class, who has, he's aspiring to move up a class. There's things that he does, like his accent and the way he speaks is really affected. He's doing some sort of version of RP, received pronunciation, I think it's called.
Mm-hmm.
He's, you know, like, he uses like words that are quite big. They're his conversation is very stilted, and it seems like he's trying to sound more educated than he might be. But then I noticed that, like, when later on in the film, when he starts to get frustrated, his Cockney really comes out. Like, mm-hmm. he starts speaking out the side of his mouth, those intonations, they start to change. And I feel like that's something that he was doing on purpose. So he seems like someone who's got all these clothes, he's got this nice house, but he doesn't wear any of that with the comfort and ease of someone who grew up with that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's interesting to kind of start off with the class part of the film, because that's such a big part of it. And I almost don't feel like he aspired to move up a class. I think it's almost a thing that he resented, knowing that he was never going to be able to do. And winning the pools was like a weird, unexpected gift. But that didn't mean that he could move up classes just because he had money and he had this house now. There is such an inherent discomfort in how he moves around the world, and particularly how he kind of, the anger that he has towards Miranda. Part of that, I definitely felt, was wrapped up in class, because he's constantly, the most aggressive scenes are the ones where he gets angry at her because he thinks that she's talking down to him, or that she's being clever, or that she thinks that he's not, and that, you know, she's this rich little girl who doesn't understand work and will never understand him and the world that he lives in.
Yeah.
And he, you know, constantly keeps talking about privileges, about money and art and university as things that are just not for people like him, quote unquote. But, you know, I wonder as well, and Terrence Stamp, the thing that I find quite baffling is that this is only his second role.
What?
In a film. Yeah, he'd only made one film prior to this, and they're both Stone Cold masterpieces.
Was it Billy Budd?
It was Billy Budd, yeah.
You're kidding. So his first film, he got an Oscar nomination, and then this is his second film.
Yeah, so he won, both him and Samantha Eggar won the acting prizes at Cannes, I believe. And also, he spoke about it as his role in Billy Budd was so angelic and this one was so devilish, that he said that in the rest of his career, he really could not reach higher highs or lower lows than with these two characters, which I find incredible as kind of, you know, a thought about your own work peaking so early, even though obviously he went on to do amazing stuff.
Yeah. But
do you think, and I think it's impossible not to talk about this, do you think that Stamp's very striking looks play into Freddy as a character.
Oh my god, how much time have you got? It is problematic how drawn I was to a young Terrence Stamp doing these terrible things on screen. He has the same kind of beauty as a young Jude Law. You know, Jude Law in in the Talented Mr. Ripley. a moment for that era. And also, he does this switch from sweet to psycho really quickly, and he's got this kind of like, he's got these striking blue eyes that are so magnetic, but then also there are times in this film when like he's it looks like they're dead behind, you know, like there's nothing behind them. I think his beauty is, it definitely works to like wrong foot you as a viewer, or maybe it's just working on me really well. I don't know. But there's something about a guy that looks like that that's a little bit, there's a bit of like, there's a disconnect because beauty's so often linked to virtue, right? And I think his magnetism occasionally kind of like caused me to put my guard down. Just whenever he showed any sort of kindness or gentility, I was immediately like, oh, maybe there's hope there. And I think that has to do with him, how he looks. And this is something that I think influences things like the Netflix TV series You, where Joe Goldberg is so attractive, like he presents so well that you can't help but put a lot of weight onto the moments when he's not being a complete psycho.
We talked about kind of the pretty privilege when we spoke about Eyes Without a Face, but you can't separate someone who looks like Terrence Stamp from, you know, those looks play a part in this. And you're right, it kind of really does discombobulate you a bit, but I think there's something so off-putting about his performance. So there's this kind of contradiction of someone like Joe in You, a series that I'll cover much later on in this series. I made a note to myself while rewatching The Collector that Freddie walked so that Joe Goldberg could run.
Absolutely.
But Joe knows how he looks, and he knows how to play into his looks and how people perceive him and how kind of fine he is. You know, he's not the hottest guy around and he's not the ugliest. He fits a particular, you know, white brown haired skinny dude from Brooklyn vibe that absolutely flies. But there's no meekness to him in the way that there is to Freddy. And Stamp does this thing where until he gets fully upset and fully violent with Miranda, he is so unbelievably timid, meek, kind of seemingly containing nothing, you know? There's nothing to him around other people, which is what actually makes him so off-putting. The fact that he's so pretty, the fact that he's got these striking looks actually doesn't help him or serve him in any way. You know, I have no doubt that Miranda, had he been normal, would have asked, if he'd asked her out, she'd be like, yeah, great, sure. Yes. Let's go for a tea. But there's this off-putting energy about him that Terrence Stamp manages to tap into. And it has so much to do with body language, I think. The way that he almost like rounds his shoulders, always is looking down and kind of makes himself smaller and kind of looking away always, but also looking at her. So he's kind of like this reluctant voyeur. And what I found really, there's nothing touching about him because of this. I found him more off-putting than a lot of the other kind of killers that I've been watching for this series that are also, you know, good looking in their own kind of classical different ways. So I'm like, I really don't want to be in a room with Freddy ever. Yeah.
There's creepy.
It almost feels like he doesn't contain anything. Like he's empty inside.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. He does. There is this emptiness behind the eyes that is really chilling. And he does this thing as well where he sort of like, he takes a little bit of a breath before he speaks to Miranda. Like he's sort of bracing himself, like he's putting on performance. But again, it's this blankness that is terrifying. It's just like Eyes Without a Face. It's this blankness that is really unsettling. Because I found myself also unsure of what his motivations actually are. I know what they are ostensibly, but I don't know what it is exactly he wants.
Well, I was thinking about this when I was watching the film, and this is why I wanted to put it in the serial killer series, because I think this entire film is like the prequel to a serial killer movie.
Yes. Yeah.
Because it is all about him figuring out what it is that he wants to get from his victims. And he does not look at them as victims. So it is so, I find it deeply disturbing because it is absolutely not using the language of serial killer movies, but it is giving us a very intense, very unjudgy, uncrime associated portrait of a serial killer as he's evolving. And this obsession, I think the key to his view of his victims, of Miranda, and, you know, a possible future is in the butterfly thing. And he collects butterflies. I think in the first scene, when we first see him, it's almost this like scene, bucolic scene of Terrence Stamp running through the fields chasing butterflies. I'm like,
very Drew Barrymore.
Yeah, but also I'm like, are you hot enough to get away with this? Oh, I don't know. I do not know.
Yeah, almost. It kind of worked for me.
But then when he shows her his collection and he's so proud, oh my God. It's like, you know, you go on a date with a dude from like Walthamstow. He shows you all of his guitar, what do you call them? Synths. Or guitar
that
filters.
That was very specific.
Yeah. It was. But, you know, and she's like, you're just surrounded by death. All of these butterflies are dead. And I think that's what he wants from Miranda. He wants her to be displayed, to be beautiful forever, to be his, but not really to speak. Because every time she says anything, he flies off in a rage. I don't think he actually likes her as a person. No. I think he's just like created almost a box that he wants to put her in, to look at her and be looked at, but not really love her and not really be loved by her, even though that's what he says he wants.
Yeah, I feel like this works really well as a serial killer origin story. Like, we don't know what happens after this film, but I can imagine this. I can imagine him evolving into someone with a very specific obsession and a very specific MO. And I think you're totally right about his view, what he wants out of Miranda. Like, I think I think Freddie wants beauty without the complication. He wants he wants a trophy. And that's actually another serial killer trope that I've just remembered. They keep trophies, don't they? That's a popular aspect of that kind of characterization. He wants beauty without a complication, which is something that's really adolescent. It's almost like you have a crush. Well, you know, you have a crush on someone that you idealize, but you don't actually know them and their, you know, their faults. And I think Miranda to him also, she represents a lifestyle. Like, he's got this idea of what love is, which I think is very nebulous still. I'm not sure he knows exactly what it is, but I think he's kind of forming. He's got the kernel of an idea, and he's starting to form it. And I think part of it is when she presents him with options, he's kind of working out what he doesn't want. I don't think he's worked out yet what he actually does want.
Yeah.
But I don't think that she's like a woman to him. I think she's beauty. She's an idea. She's a lifestyle. A little bit kind of like maybe a little bit like Daisy Buchanan and Gatsby.
Mm-hmm. She's a butterfly.
I think
Gatsby does sort of love Daisy despite all her many flaws. But I think Miranda, I do love the way that this film is so much a two-hander between the killer and the victim.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe, you know, the collector truthers will be like, well, he doesn't actually kill her. She dies from pneumonia because they have a fight in the rain. By the way, can we talk about the seduction scene that leads into the fight in the rain, please?
It's so awkward. It's so hot. What?
Oh, I'm... No. I was jumping forward to the scene in the rain. Sorry, not the seduction scene. That is bad. Oh, my
God. I was just... Thank God. Oh, my God. No. Let's be clear. Terrence Stamp in a white t-shirt? Hot.
We were texting about this last night or the other night. Terrence Stamp in a white shirt, superior to Colin Firth in a wet white shirt, and
facts.
Jonathan Bailey in a wet white shirt.
Facts. Fight me on this.
Fact. Don't come at me. No. Look at the images.
Yeah.
I rest my case.
Yeah. The eyes and the water.
Stop it.
I mean, yeah, and... Terrence Stamp, email me, please. Let's have coffee.
Wait, so what is the... So let's go back to the very awkward, very bad, very weird seduction scene.
Oh, I felt bad for Miranda because I could see why she's doing it. It's sad because, like, I think she's doing it... Do you think there's a part of her that... is kind of like giving him what he wants because he's shown some sort of kindness to her. This is what I can't figure out about this film, because so much of it is shot and scored like a romance, and it's styled like a romance. It almost looks like, you know, like a Lady Guinevere era, whatever that is, medieval, I mean, it's Tudor era, romance. So when we get to the seduction scene, what the hell am I looking at? Is this her method of escaping, or does she kind of want to show him a kindness? What do you think?
I think it's all a way to escape. I don't think she ever fully gets, you know, into him at all. I think she's very clear-headed and scared of him, but trying to, because it is very nebulous, like, what he wants from her, and she's constantly trying to be like, what do you want? Do you want money? Do you want to assault me? Like, what do you? It's like, oh, I want you to love me, and you would love me if you tried, but you don't try. So because it is sort of about him figuring out his modus operandi and his. I'm talking about, like, he's an artist, but that's not how I mean it. His, like, killer vision, you know, the thing that is going to make him happy and content and fulfilled.
He doesn't know it yet.
So he's, like, articulating it in terms of love, but that's not love.
No.
It's so twisted. So he doesn't actually know, you know, does he want to just, like, kill her and keep her there? Not really, but maybe. So I think it's all a ploy to try to get, you know, maybe to get him to relax or to fall asleep so then maybe she could leave, or to forget to lock the door or something.
Yeah.
And I think perhaps, like, almost because there is this, you know, they do kind of negotiate, like, I'll give you this amount of days, this amount of weeks, and then you let me go. So she's, you know, counting down the days and working towards that until she can be let go.
And she doesn't even try to hide that.
No, she paints it on the wall.
Yeah, I know, which again confused me, because I'm just like, there is some sort of element of trust going on between you two. And does that come from Terrence? Sorry, I keep calling him Terrence. Does that come from Freddie's mannerisms and the way he presents himself? Like, there's something about him that is so confusing. Yeah, I don't... It's so awkward. And the worst thing is that she's tried everything else. This is the, I feel like the last thing she, this is her last resort. And we don't know, and she doesn't know whether it's going to work. We think it's going to work because we know that, you know, in situations like these that are lit like this and that are presented like this, this normally works. This is normally when someone's boundaries get broken down. And when it doesn't, I felt, I was like, no. I was like, no. It was just, terrible.
I feel like the confrontation that we get between them in the rain outside as Miranda's trying to escape is particularly violent.
Yep.
Nothing much really happens. You know, yeah, they're just kind of tussling around, but there's so much desperation on her part to run away and on his part to keep her, to get her back in the basement.
Yeah. Yeah, the when she's being dragged and there's that low angle shot of just like basically like her lower body being dragged into the dungeon, there's something so it's just so visceral about that. It's not like the rest of the film where there's warmth and, you know, soft lighting. It's very, very stark. And is it the first time that we've seen him be physically threatening?
He's physically threatening to her in sort of conversation when he's kind of standing over her and yelling at her. But this is definitely the most physical that they get. And this is what I mean also by like how the Collector is a really interesting take on the serial killer film. Because he doesn't actually murder her. He creates the environment in which she dies and he doesn't help save her. You know, it's not like she's dying of some terrible wound. You know, she gets sick from the rain and then perishes. But I want to talk a little bit about the ending, because I think that's when it clicks into place. Yeah. That this is not about Miranda at all.
No.
It's about this pathology and this obsession that's just starting. How does the ending change the entire film for you?
This is when it becomes a serial killer film. This is, I feel like as a serial killer film, this is interesting because this isn't normally where we see, this isn't normally the point of their pathology that we see them. Normally, like, this would be the flashback. This film would be the flashback of, like, say, for example, a series like You. This would be, like, their starting point. I think that the ending is what sealed it for me. I was like, okay, he's starting to figure out. He definitely knows what he doesn't want anymore. He's starting to figure out what it is that he's after. He's gone. So at the very end, he decides to select another victim. And that victim is a nurse, which is very different to Miranda, who's an art student with a, you know, like with a middle class family who moves through the world in a, you know, very easy way. He's going for a nurse. This is going to be someone who is probably maybe from a similar background to him. I don't know. But I think he's like, okay, that didn't work. Maybe this is going to get me what I want. I don't know yet, but I'm going to try it. And I also found his reaction to her death, to Miranda's death, really telling as well, because he kind of, suddenly he switches. Suddenly she's not this ideal thing for him anymore. He blames her for her own death. And he's like, well, I did everything perfectly. She is the one who didn't react the way I wanted her to.
Yeah.
And now she's dead. And then he just sort of throws her away as if she's like, you know, like
she's lost all meaning. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, he says this really chilling thing of it was her own fault. But, you know, I can find someone new, someone I could teach. Teach what, Freddie? How to catch butterflies? But there's also this thing, you know, going back to what you were saying about beauty and how beauty is so central to both of these films. There's also this thing of, has Miranda lost her value to him because as she got sick, she was no longer beautiful to him?
Interesting. I feel like she lost her value to him when she tried to seduce him, because he's got this sort of aversion to sex, which is really I don't think he fully understands, and I definitely didn't understand as the viewer. It's like something about when someone becomes fleshy, he's sort of repulsed by it.
Yeah.
I think he likes beauty that he can put behind a glass, just like with the butterflies. But then once it becomes like human, you know, flesh and like the sort of like tactile part of attraction, he doesn't know how to deal with it.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a kind of almost like, oh, sex is dirty.
Yeah.
And beauty is different from sex. And maybe it's almost like an impotence that obviously is never really addressed, but it's kind of implied because he can't consummate sex with her, which is another constant of serial killer movies. We see a lot of them kind of, you know, being very sex driven and sex obsessed, but unable to actually have sex.
Yeah.
And before I wrap up, Maha, is there anything about either of these films that you wanted to bring up?
I think that I found that argument about the Catcher in the Rye very interesting, because I feel like that's an argument I've had with like annoying men before as well. So that was a very real moment. But no, I think we've discussed everything that I want to talk about.
Amazing! Thank you so much for coming on, and I'm glad you got to discover both of these movies.
Thank you, Anna. Thank you for bringing more young Terrence Stamp into my life.